Our morning today's daf is Ayin Zayin. 77. It should be the last daf in the perek. It is the last daf in the perek. Okay, already correction. It is the last daf in the perek. Hopefully, what I'm hoping is that we'll finish it. I'm going to go a little fast today, and first part of today is going to be challenging and difficult, but after that, it's pretty smooth sailing until we get to the end of the perek. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship. Daf is Lons Vechanish Mazli B'Gavriela Bashmuel. Also, Mazel Tov on the birth of a grandson. And Eretz Yisrael, nonetheless. Okay, the Mishnah that we are still coming off of is it seems to have a discrepancy. The Mishnah takes us all the way back to Ayin Ham and Aleph, and the Mishnah talks about where she had blemishes, and the Mishnah seems to be contradicting itself. On one hand, the Mishnah says burden of proof in terms of these blemishes when they occurred. Remember, the blemishes occurred while after she got married, so it's unfortunate for him, but that's it. In other words, nistap chasadeu. If the blemishes come before she gets married, so then that's her issue. It's something she should have disclosed to her husband. She didn't. And so, who's the burden of proof on to make this case? So the Mishnah gives us conflicting reports. So first, the Mishnah says that the burden of proof falls on her and her father. The second half of the Mishnah says that the burden of proof falls on the husband. So how do you resolve that discrepancy? So there were three approaches amongst the Amoraim. Just quickly to review, this is really all of yesterday's daf. Rav Elazar, which goes all the way back to Ayin Ham and Beis. Rav Elazar says Tabra. You got to break the Mishnah up. Misha Shanazu, Lo Shanazu. If you learned one way in the Mishnah, so you're not going to learn the other way in the Mishnah. Meaning, the first half of the Mishnah that says the responsibility, the burden of responsibility falls on her and her father. Is going like Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yoshua says we don't believe her generally. In other words, obviously, if she brings proof and she has evidence, so that's fine. But just on word alone, we don't believe her. And the second half of the Mishnah that says that we believe him, so that's going like Rabbi Gamliel. Good. That's the opinion of Rav Elazar in terms of how to resolve the discrepancy, or otherwise stated, there is no resolution. That's how you learn the Mishnah. Rava gives a different answer. Rava says it depends on when the point of the discovery of the blemish occurred. If the point of discovery occurred while she was still in her father's house, so then burden of proof falls on her and her father. If the discovery of the blemishes occurs after she enters into her husband's domain, so then the burden of proof falls on him. That's Rava's explanation of the Mishnah. And then Ravashi's last approach, which we saw yesterday, and we finished up yesterday with Ravashi, was that it depends who the towing is. It depends who is making the argument. If the father's making the argument, now why would the father be making the argument? So as we explained yesterday, because we're talking about a case where she's a ketana or a nara, she's still under the jurisdiction of the father, and all the earnings and all the benefits and all the money would go to the father. So therefore, he's really the one advocating. He's not advocating. It's him. He's the towing. He's the one making the claim. So then he's got the burden of proof is on him, as opposed to where she becomes an adult or she gets married. Either way. So now she is being towed on behalf of herself, and she's testifying about her own body. Like I explained yesterday, she's an expert witness on her own body. So there, our Mishnah is in totality going like Rabbi Gamliel, but therefore we believe her as opposed to him, and therefore the burden of proof falls on him, not on her. Okay, Adkan. Though that's the Mishnah. Those are the three explanations of the Mishnah, and then the Gemara says, and then it takes us to another area in Halacha. Seemingly, it takes us to another area in Halacha, and that's the following. I'm Rav Yudah Mishmuel. So I'm going to begin the Gemara today, and I involve a Madalev on the bottom. We did this yesterday, but let's start again. I'm Rav Yudah Mishmuel. I'm Achlif Par B'Chamor. So let's say we barter. So Hedi, you and I are going to barter with each other, and I'm going to be the Baal Chamor. I'm going to be the owner of the donkey, and you're going to be the owner of a cow. Okay, it takes us back to the good old days. We're not bartering like this anymore. And in this barter, we do the following. So you look at my donkey, I look at your cow, everything looks great. And so what do I do? We agree, we shake hands. And what do? I'm Moshech. I pull your cow. So I pull your cow, and then that one act of Mashiach, two things occur simultaneously. Number one, because I do Mashiach, so therefore now I'm the proud owner of your cow because I did a Mashiach. Number two is that because it's a barter, so when I create the kinyan for myself, I'm also creating a kinyan for you. And you are now going to be the proud owner of the donkey. What happens, however, I'm Rav Yehuda Mishmuel, I'm Achlif Par B'Chamor, U'mashuch Baal Chamor Sapara, and I pull the... And I pull the cow, v'lo yitzpik balapar limshoch es hachamor, and then had he come over to my house, and what happens? And you find that the donkey's dead. So ad shemeis hachamor. Okay, so now, we obviously have a problem. This was a barter, and in the barter, the agreement was, I'm going to exchange my donkey for your cow, and with the expectation, of course, is that the exchange is only fair if both animals are alive. I mean, in other words, the terms are very simple. You want a live animal, I want a live animal. So when I pulled on your cow, so I created a kingdom for both of us, but meanwhile, when you come over to my house, the donkey's dead. So who is the burden of proof upon? Who has to make the case that the donkey was alive at the time when I pulled the cow, and it's just your unfortunate luck? So who has to make that case? So Rabbi Yehuda ben Shmuel says, you know who's responsible? Me. I'm responsible. And my responsibility forces me to make a case that in actuality the donkey was alive at the time when I pulled the cow, and if I can't make a case, so then the transaction is off, it's voided. And the Gemara says, and you want to know where you're gonna uncover this halacha, you'll find it from our Mishnah. Okay, it is a little bit, more than a little bit interesting, that what happens is that I create a kinyan, meaning I'm the one who is doing the mashicha. Now because I pulled on your cow now is in my possession, and now the burden of proof falls upon me. That is interesting, if we think about it for just a moment. Generally speaking, what do we say? We say that now, Hedy's coming after me and is saying to me, look, you know, you're a nice guy and all, but the donkey's dead. I said, okay, but I'm holding the cow right now. I'm an owner. I'm a muchzak. I'm the one holding it. And meanwhile, Rabbi Yehuda ben Shmuel says the burden of proof is on me. That is interesting. For a lengthy discussion on this point, which I'm not going to go through right now, because I know what we have to get through today. So see the bottom Tosos who discusses this point. It is very interesting. Right now, the Gemara is arguing that the burden of proof is on me. Now, Gemara is making a connection between the case that we just described, the cow donkey, and our Mishnah. And what case are we talking about, and where is the analogy? So, Hi Kala. The Gemara's question. Which Kala case are we talking about? Elema Kala Bebeis Aviha. Are we talking about the case where she was still in her father's house? And as Rashi explains over here, we're learning the Mishnah right now like Rav Elazar, and meaning that the first case of the Mishnah is going like the opinion of Rav Yehoshua. And what did Rav Yehoshua say? Rav Yehoshua says that we, generally speaking, do not believe her. So the Gemara says, Midami. And the Gemara says, well, that's not comparable. Hasa maisi avrayo mapik. Because in that case over there, the burden of proof is on the father. And when he does successfully make his case, then what happens? He's extracting money from the husband. Over here, when I successfully make my case, if I successfully make my case, I'm not extracting money from Hedy. The only thing I'm doing is preventing him from taking away my cow. So it's not analogous. So the Gemara just wonders. It's, in other words, we're making a comparison between the case of donkey cow and the Mishnah, but it's not really a good comparison. It's not a correct comparison. So, it's not analogous. I'm Rabbi Abba Kala Beveis Chameha. So the Gemara says, okay, let's move on to the next case of the Mishnah. Next case of the Mishnah is where we're going to go like Rabbi Gamliel, where Rabbi Gamliel says we believe her. Ve'akati lo dami. So if we're believing her, so who's the burden of proof fall upon? Falls upon the husband. So the Gemara says, but it's also not analogous. Hasam la maisi raya umari le lechazke. Because what the husband's going to do is he's going to bring a proof, and what is it going to do? It's going to discredit. Meaning the arguments are going in two different directions. The argument in the case of the cow donkey is what I'm trying to argue now is as follows. I own the cow, and my argument is I own the cow. I'm trying to substantiate the idea that I'm in fact not just holding the cow, but I'm the owner of the cow. I want to improve my position, as opposed to the case of the husband and the wife, where we're not believing the husband, and the husband's got to create a case. So it's true he's creating a case, and it's true he's going to be holding the money, but his case that he's creating is that he's going to discredit her position. So again, it's not really a fair analogy. I'm Rav Nachman Yitzchak, but Kala Bebeis Aviyah LeKiddushin. So the Gemara says, okay, you're right. Right now we have not created a good analogy between the cases. Consider the following. Let's go back to the first scenario where she's in her father's house. And as Rashi points out over here, we're no longer learning the Mishnah like Rav Elazar, but now we're going to be learning the Mishnah like Rava. Now when you learn the Mishnah like Rava, and she's in her father's house. So what is now the position? The position is that she and her father have to be the ones making the case. V'lo tema aliba demand, I'm sorry, before I go on to the Gemara. And if the father and, if her and her father have to be the ones making the case now, and the case for what? The case for the fact that she had a blemish, and the blemish predated the the blemish occurred after the Kiddushin. And now, how is it a good analogy? It's a good analogy in the following sense. Because the money we're talking about is not the Ksuva money. The money we're talking about is the Kiddushin money. Okay? In other words, we know when you marry a woman, you give her Kesef Kiddushin, you give her money. And now, basically, what the husband is saying to her is, look, you had blemishes, you didn't tell me about it. And furthermore, not only are you not going to get a Ksuva, but you know what? I want my Kesef Kiddushin back. Meaning, I give you Kesef Kedushin, but on the condition, of course, that we're going to get married. But you didn't tell me about these blemishes. You didn't disclose them. So not only you're not going to get Ksuva, but you're also, give me back my Kesef Kedushin. And now what is she trying to argue, her and her father? She's trying to argue these blemishes just came about. So now it is an excellent analogy. It's a perfect analogy. Because now her argument is that she is making a case for herself that she, in fact, is entitled to that Kesef of Kedushin. So she's arguing to improve her position so that she gets to keep the money. Now it's a good. It's a perfect analogy. Here in the case of cow donkey, again, I'm the donkey owner. Heidi's a cow owner. So I take the cow, and now the donkey's dead. And I am now, the burden of responsibility is upon me to make a case that I really do own the cow, so I'm making an argument, that, and not just an argument, I have to bring proof and evidence, but I'm making a case that I'm in fact the owner of the cow in order so that I can retain my money that I have, meaning the cow. Good. So now that we're here, we do have a good analogy. And then the Gemara just simply points out that there's a tangential issue. Is there a return on Kesef Kedushin? Meaning, is that possible? V'lo tema liba d'man d'amar Kedushin lav l'tov v'nitnu. Now the Gemara says this is a machlokas in the Gemara. Oddly enough, it's a machlokas in the Gemara Baba Basra. Meaning, it seems like such a basic issue, and it seems like it should be discussed in Gemara Kedushin. Okay, but it isn't. And so you'll find the Baba Basra. And the Gemara over there discusses the following. Let's say you hand a girl Kesef Kedushin, and for whatever reason, it just doesn't work out. You not because you divorced her, but whatever. In other words, some information was disclosed. Whatever the case is, so can the Kesef Kedushin be returned? Meaning, let's put it in other terms. When you give Kesef Kedushin, is that money really conditional? Conditional on the fact that we get married. So that the Gemara Baba Basra discusses and debates. And the Gemara over here says, look, even though that is an issue that's debated, it's not relevant to our discussion. Because the Gemara says, even if Kesef Kedushin, generally speaking, you have the position that it's Tivuin. Tivuin means it's sunk, it's lost. There's no, it's not a conditional money. It's money that you give. Hani mila Kedushin vadai, that's only the Kedushin or definitive Kedushin. Ava Kedushin tos, but over here, this is not a Kedushin that worked, it's a Kedushin that from the very beginning, from the origination, at least that's what he's arguing, you had blemishes, you didn't tell me about the blemishes, it's not even a Kedushin under those circumstances. Of course the money's going to come back. So, Imai Saraya in Ilo. Okay, good. So, now, we have the halacha of Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel about the cow and the donkey. I pulled on the cow. Hedy comes over to my house, he finds the donkey's dead. Burden of proof, says Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, is on me. I have to now make the case that the donkey was alive at the time of when I pulled. And if I don't make the case, so then Hedy's going to get back his cow. Good. And how is it analogous to our Mishnah? Because we're talking about Kesef Kedushin, where a discovery that she had blemishes in the house of her father, she has to make a case now so that she gets to keep her Kesef Kedushin. Good. That is so far where we're at. Make sure the Gemara challenges based on a Mishnah in Chulin. The Mishnah in Chulin discusses the following Machash and Nimsis Ba'ovei Beis HaKosos Mitzad Echek Sher Mishnei Tzadim Treifa. Okay, I do not want to get too deep into this discussion of the Gemara right now. So just peripherally, ruminating animal has four stomachs. We're talking about now stomachs number two and three. Stomachs number two and three the animal will be considered a trefa if you have a penetration, a hole going through either one of the stomachs. The second stomach in the Gemara is referred to as the Beis HaKosos. If you take a look at the pictures and you take a look at the shape, you will see why it's called the Beis HaKosos. But anyway, we're describing the second stomach of a cow. And what happens is that you find a needle in the stomach. So, generally speaking, we don't assume that the animal's a trefa, but if an examination is done, and if you find a needle, and the needle is in the lining of the stomach. Now, back in those days, back to even today, cows are not really that discerning when they eat. It's very possible that a needle just went right into their stomach. So, if the needle didn't make a full penetration through the stomach, the animal's not a trefa. If the needle made a full penetration through the stomach, so then the animal's a trefa. What about the fact that maybe while the animal was alive and while you shechted the animal, the needle didn't go all the way through, and then after you shechted the animal, because you're really applying force to various parts of the animal as you're taking out the intestines and the stomachs, so maybe then the needle went through. So it is an interesting discussion. So you can use forensic evidence in order to determine whether or not the needle went through after you shechted the animal. If you find blood on the other side of the wall of the stomach, so that means that not only did the needle go through, but there was also a communication of blood that went from one side to the other. And you see karadam, so then you know biyadush ulifnei shechita. Now you know that it was that the needle penetrated the entire lining of the wall before shechita. Okay, lo nimtzala hadam. I'm sorry, lo nimtzala karadam. But what if you didn't find blood? Biyadush ula acher shechita. So now you know that the needle went through only after shechita. Good. I know huglad piyamake. What if there was a some sort of scab that formed over the hole? Biyadusha shoshiyamim kodesh shechita. You know that it occurred 3 days prior to shechita. Lo huglad piyamake hamotze mechaver al averaya. And if there is not a scab that formed over the hole, so now hamotze mechaver al averaya. So now, what happens to the money? Meaning, we're describing a scenario where the butcher bought the animal from a farmer, and now, what about the money? Money stays where the money is. Okay, which only leads to the following question. There are more details in this Mishnah which I'm not uncovering right now. When we get to Chulin, we'll do it obviously much better. But right now, we're just focusing on one aspect, and that is, who is the burden of proof fall upon? Well, right now, the Mishnah ends off with just one statement, and that is, whoever's holding the money, he gets to keep it. Now, so the Gemara says, now, the butcher was a buyer over here. He bought it from the farmer. So the butcher, if he gave money, so by la sui raya umapik. So burden of proof is now on whom? So burden of proof now is on the butcher. V'amai ba behema laisi raya v'nokim. In other words, based on what we just learned together, when there was a transaction, and we don't know whether or not the transaction was on an animal that was a ksherer or a trefa. We just simply don't know. And there's a scab, but the scab does not, there was no scab. So we do not have enough forensic evidence. We just simply don't know whether when the animal was sold, was it a trefa or was it not a trefa. And now we're assuming that the butcher already sent the money over to the farmer. And so now you have a transaction. The problem, of course, is animal may have been a trefa at the time. Problem now is that we just learned together, in the case of the donkey and the cow, in the case of our Mishnah regarding the woman, that the burden of proof falls upon whom? The burden of proof falls upon the one creating the transaction. Meaning in the case of the donkey and cow, me. In the case of the kala, she. In order for her to hold her money, in order for me to hold my money, because Hedy's coming after me, in those cases, the burden of proof falls upon me, the holder of the money. And meanwhile, the Mishnah says, seemingly, that the burden of proof falls on the butcher. And why? He's not the one holding the money. It's right now the farmer holding the money. So the Gemara says, but the lo yeftavcha damei. So the Gemara says, well, maybe the Mishnah over there is talking about a case where there was no money exchanged. So the Gemara says, my pasca. The Gemara says, really? That's usually how transactions are done? Where you buy something, you buy it on credit, meaning, yes, it's possible, but why would the Mishnah assume that that's the case? So the Gemara says, okay, what we're going to do now is we are going to change gears. Eloki asked Rami Bar Yecheskel. Gemara has this line come up a couple of times. Rami Bar Yecheskel says, Amar lo tetzatzin al hanikla adekha Yehuda achai mishmet deshmuel. Look, my brother Yehuda, I know he quoted Shmuel, but on this issue, do not listen to him. Hachi Amar Shmuel, he says, Rami Bar Yecheskel says, this is what Shmuel said. Kol shenola tzafi berushuso, alav araya. If the suffix occurs in your domain, so now the burden of proof befalls on you. Vitanatuna kala, and now, meaning it was the same statement of Shmuel, more or less, but with one very significant change. And that is, burden of proof is not on me in the case of cow donkey. Burden of proof now falls on Hedy. Because the suffix fell while it was in his domain. Meaning, again, let's go over the case of the cow donkey. I'm the owner of a donkey, Hedy's the owner of a cow. Everything's well and good. My cow's alive, my donkey's alive, his cow's alive. And what do? I pull on his cow. At this point in time now, good, transaction done. Now he comes over, and now he finds his donkey, right? Because he bought it, and the Kenyan was my pulling on the cow. His donkey's dead. So now, and he's going to make the argument that died before the transaction occurred. So we don't know. That's not the issue. The issue is, who's the burden of proof fall upon? So now in this change in position, now Rami Bar Yecheskel says in the name of Shmuel, burden of proof is on Hedy. And we know this because of our Mishnah. And now, our Mishnah is an excellent proof to that point. Meisvei, the Gemara says, okay, I'm going to challenge you based on that Mishnah in Chulin. Machashinim says, Bovei Beisako says, V'chulei. The Gemara just simply says, remember the Mishnah in Chulin? We just saw it a couple lines ago. V'dolo yav tavach dami ba behema bailas durirayu mapik. V'yamayt sveka brishus tavach izyalit. Now the Gemara says, now, if the butcher didn't pay for the meat, and the Mishnah says, hamotzi mechaveh olav araya, that means now that it becomes the responsibility of the farmer to bring a proof. So the Gemara says, no. The Mishnah is describing a scenario where the butcher paid. So the Gemara says, my pasca. And the Gemara says, is that a fair assumption? The Gemara says, yeah, that is a fair assumption. The Gemara says, yes, that's normal. Because in generally in transactions, I'm not going to give you the cow until you give me the money. So it is normally fair to assume that there was a not only a transaction but money paid as well. And now money paid as well. So now the Mishnah in Chulin says, so who is now the burden of proof fall upon? The butcher. The butcher has the burden of proof because the money now has been handed over to the farmer, and now the butcher is looking at this animal and he shechted the animal. Needle went right through the stomach of the animal. The animal's a trefa. And there was no scabbing that was formed, so we don't know how far back this goes. So he meaning the butcher, now has the burden of proof because the suffix occurred while it's in his possession, and now he's trying to extract money from the farmer. Hamotzi mechaveh olav araya. Okay, so that's the case now of the donkey cow. So now the burden of proof would fall on Hedy, which, as we pointed out, That's the more sensible position in the fact that I know I own the cow. I did a mashiach on the cow. And now Hedy's coming to me and saying to me, well, I don't know if it was a good transaction. The donkey's dead. Okay, he's right. We don't know. But you're coming after me and you're trying to take money out of money, or in this case, a cow out of my hands. You need positive evidence that this, in fact, was so. And the same thing is true with the case of our Mishnah. In the case of the Mishnah, you're trying to extract money from somebody else. In this case, the woman is trying to extract money from the husband. She has to bring proof in order to do so. Okay, so in the end the Gemara settles on the position that the burden of proof falls on wherever the suffix lands on, whosever domain the suffix lands in. Back to the Mishnah. In our Mishnah, finishing up now our Mishnah that we started all the way back on Ayin Hay Amud Beis, the Mishnah brings in the opinion of the Chachamim. Remember, by the way, just as a parenthetical, the Mishnah starts on Ayin Hay Amud Aleph. As a parenthetical note, everything we discussed up until now since the Mishnah has been the opinion of Rabbi Meir. The Chachamim make just a very simple distinction. I agree with Rabbi Meir, says the Chachamim, that's only but blemishes that are normally covered. But if it's a blemish that is open and revealed, so then he can't make a taina, he cannot make a claim. Reason's very simple. Because if the blemish is in an area which is not normally covered, husband obviously saw it. And obviously, he's okay with it. So, Amar Rav Nachman, we're now on the top of Ayin Zayin Amud Aleph, V'nichbe b'mumen shebaseis adameh. If someone's suffering seizures, she's suffering seizures, so what? How do we view that? Is that considered concealed or open? Or revealed? So the Gemara says, very clearly, it's considered concealed. Why is it considered concealed? So Rashi writes, the last Rashi before the next Mishnah, Lefishin is heres b'yom zmana mi latseis b'in abriyos. Because it's something which is generally timed. I understand if it's not, we'll discuss that in just a moment. But something that's timed, then she knows when she's basically going to have a seizure, so she could put herself in a private situation so that nobody knows that she suffers from seizure. Which brings us to the next point in the Gemara. Bahani miladik v'yaleizman. Avalok v'yalei kimumim shebegaloi dami. So that means then that if these seizures are totally unpredictable and she can have them at any point in time, so that's no longer considered a private blemish. That's no longer considered a mumshe. But because it comes at any given point in time, so then the husband can't make the argument, I didn't know about it. It's something which obviously is going to get discovered at an earlier point in time. So that's considered mum shebegalui. Okay. And now all this brings us, of course, to the men. Ha'ish shenolda b'mumen. What if the man has a blemish? Ain kofenos alahotzi. So the Mishnah's, the Tanakhama's viewpoint is, we don't force a divorce. Amar Shimon Gamliel, ba'med var mamurim b'mumen makitanim. So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, well, that's only talking about small blemishes. Ava mumen magadolim kofenos alahotzi. But if we're talking about large blemishes, which the Gemara is going to identify in just a moment, so then we force a divorce. We tell the husband that he must divorce this woman if he's suffering from big blemishes. Interesting. Take a look at the first Tosfos on the Amud. Mumim gedolim kofenos alahatzi. If it's large mumim, so then we force the divorce. Gabi ish like lamemra din stop chasade shel isha. Now, what do we say when it comes to a woman getting married, developing blemishes after she gets married? So we've seen since the beginning of the Masechta, we have an argument of nistab chasadeo. It's unfortunate, but that's your lot in life, meaning right, I'm the woman you chose, and it's not something I didn't disclose. It's something that happened after we got married, so we have a concept of nistab chasadeo. Look, it's unfortunate for you, but you know, I'm your wife, and this is what you got. For the husband, we don't say that. Why not? So, the ish enu sada shal ishto kedeprisha brish mechilton. Because, says Tosfos, goes back to the basic definition of marriage. And we're talking about the first stage of marriage. The basic definition of marriage is, it's a kinyan. We're not objectifying, it's just simply the mechanism in which marriage is created is the idea that a man marries a woman. A man marries a woman, meaning he's kona the woman. And so therefore, in the analogy, and the analogy, by the way, goes back all the way to the Gzera Shava, between how we even learn that a man can acquire a woman through Kesef Kedushin. It's learned out through the Gzera Shava of Sadeh Sadeh from Steh Chevron. So the idea is that a woman can say to a man, look, I'm using language that just simply demonstrates this idea. You purchased me, and now something happens after the purchase. That's after the purchase. Nistab chasadeo. But the man doesn't have that option. The man can't say to the woman, look, I'm really sorry, but it's your tough luck. Because It's not her tough luck. She didn't buy him. She didn't acquire him. He acquired her. So therefore, you don't have that possibility. And so therefore, if he develops a blemish after they get married, so then the woman can legitimately say, "I'm not interested," and you can force the divorce. So interesting. Tosfos really touches on the very basic definition of marriage. We turn to the Gemara. Rav Yehuda Tani Noldu Chia Barav Tani Hayu. Okay, the question of what is the correct girsa of the Mishnah? Is it that there were blemishes or the blemishes just occurred? Look, if the correct way to learn the Mishnah, if the correct girsa of the Mishnah is noldu, so that means that in the case of the Mishnah, if he develops the blemishes, so the according to the Tanakhama, the marriage is still in force, and certainly if he had the blemishes beforehand, because she knew about it beforehand, and she said, "Afal pikein, I'm okay with it." But mandamar hayu aval no dulo. However, if it's hayu, if the correct way to learn the first case, the first opinion of the Mishnah is that he had blemishes, so that would mean then that if the blemishes only came after they get married, so then that is grounds for dissolvement of the marriage. But Tanan, the Gemara says, but look at the next line of the Mishnah. The appearance of Gamliel is that we're going to make a distinction between small and large. Now, if we're talking about blemishes that came after they got married, the man developed them after they got married, so then I totally understand a large blemish versus a small blemish. Small blemish, tolerable. Large blemish, intolerable. Elamand amar hayu. But if we're talking about blemishes that he had prior to the marriage, and she knew going in that he had these blemishes, mali gedolim, mali ketanim. What difference does it make whether they're large or small? Hasavra v'kibla. The Gemara says she knew about it. She accepted it. So the Gemara says, yeah, there's knowing about it and then there's living with it. By small blemishes, she's like, oh, it's okay. Right, like we described yesterday, an extra toe, fine. But when it comes to a large blemish, she said she can handle it. Okay, good. We think a lot of things. We think we could do a lot of things. But then when she actually is living with him and it's a large blemish, so then we can understand what Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is telling us is, even if she knew about it, she could still make the argument, I knew about it, and I thought I can handle it, but I can't.
What's the mechanism that she uses?
It's not going to be a mekach taos. It's going to be that it's just an intolerable situation. We've discussed a number of times now through this parak and in previous parakim that if either one of them is creating an intolerable situation, so then the chachamim are going to coerce the divorce. The Elohim Mumim Gedolim. So, and what are examples of Mumim Gedolim? Pirsho Shimon Gamliel, Kigon, Nismes, Eno. So, let's say he gets blind in one eye. Niktas Yado, one of his hands gets severed. Nishbaraglo, one of his legs, the literal translation is broken, but broken leg is not a good translation. It means that one of his legs becomes totally disabled. So, those are considered big blemishes, and those kinds of blemishes, Rav Shimon Gamliel says, that's grounds for dissolvement of the marriage, meaning we're going to encourage / coerce the husband to divorce his wife. Itmar Rabbi, according to Shimon Gamliel, Itmar Rabbi Abba Bar Yaakov Amar Rabbi Yochanan Alachik Shimon Gamliel. So the Gemara quotes in the name of one Amora, quoting Rabbi Yochanan, that the Alach in fact goes like Shimon Gamliel. So again, a distinction between small and large blemishes. Rav Amar Rav Nachman Alachik Gedivrei Chachamim. The Gemara quotes Rav in the name of Rav Nachman that the Alach falls like Rav, like the Chachamim. Omi Amar Rabbi Yochanan Hachi. The Gemara says, but wait one second. Vahamar Abba Bar Barchan Amar Rabbi Yochanan Bchomakam Shanar Shimon Gamliel B'Mishnah. You know, Rav Yochanan gives a ringing endorsement to any position of Rav Shimon Gamliel throughout Mishnayos, with three exceptions. Please forgive me. I'm not going to go through the three exceptions right now, but this is not one of them. Only in three exceptions, Rav Yochanan always follows the opinion of Shimon ben Gamliel. And so what bothers the Gemara right now is that why then does Rav Yochanan have to say, sorry, the question's not Rav Yochanan, but the Amora who quoted Rav Yochanan, Rabbi Abba Bar Yaakov, why does he have to tell us that according to Rav Yochanan, you know, in our Mishnah, halacha falls like Shimon ben Gamliel. We know Rav Yochanan almost always follows Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, and we know the three times where he doesn't, and this is not one of them. So Amrayni Novali b'Rav Yochanan. So the Gemara says it's not a small issue, but that detail is subject to a debate. Meaning, does Rav Yochanan always fall like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel? I'm subject to a debate. Obviously, Rabbi Abba Bar Yaakov does not feel that he always falls like Shimon ben Gamliel, which is why he needed to highlight over here that the halacha, in fact, goes like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Okay, and by the way, Eddie, the halacha over here goes like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, a distinction between small blemishes and large blemishes. Ve'elu shekofen oso lo hotzi. The mission now continues now. Not perfectly clear if this is a continuation of the Tanakhama's opinion or Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's opinion. Seemingly the latter, but that's not perfectly clear. But we're going to be describing now various blemishes that a man's going to be suffering from, which creates an intolerable marriage, which is going to force Beis Din's hand to force a divorce. So a number of different conditions, we'll call them, in terms of where we're going to force the divorce. Mukeshchim we generally describe as boils. Bal polipos, stay tuned, the Gemara is going to discuss that. Mekamets, he's not just a garbage collector, but he deals with excrement, dog excrement. We'll talk more about that later as well. Hamitzarif nechoshes, he's a miner, mining copper. Haborsi, or he's a tanner. These last three. These last three that we just described, what the problem is, he's foul smelling. I mean, he comes home at night and he smells terrible, and it's an odor that he just cannot get rid of, and again, it's just intolerable. Maybe change professions, but it's interesting. The Mishnah, I guess the Mishnah is assuming we're talking about a case where it's in his blood, and this is what he does for a living, and he loves it. And switching professions is just simply not an option. So and it doesn't matter whether they occur before they get married or after they get married. And even if she says to him, you know, I know you're a tanner, but you're a wonderful guy, and we'll work through it. And then after some time of marriage, she says, you know, here's what I thought. I don't think that way anymore. So that, Rameir says, is a legitimate argument. So the Chachamim disagree on this point, which is that if she knew about it beforehand and she accepted upon herself beforehand, so then she committed herself to this marriage, and we don't force a divorce. Chutz mimukashchim, with exception to boy, mimneshem mimakaso. Mimneshem mimakaso, and the only exception to that are boils, because boils is something which the situation doesn't improve, and as Rashi points out over here, the act of relations between husband and wife only exacerbates the situation, and so therefore it's just simply an intolerable marriage. And even if she knew about it, Rabbi Meir would tell, I'm sorry, the Chachamim would argue that it's still just an intolerable situation. There was a story in Sidon where there was a tanner and he was married and there was a wonderful relationship. Unfortunately, he died. And now in comes the brother. Now it's a family business. The brother is tanning as well. Here, she can make the following argument. Look, I know you're the brother. I know there's a mitzvah of Yibum, and I know you can make the argument. This is her talking. I know you can make the argument that I'm used to the smell, but look, I'm really not used to the smell. I like your brother. So in other words, despite the fact that he came home every night and he did not emit a pleasant odor, but I really liked him. You, on the other hand, not so much. And it's a legitimate argument that she can make, is that I was ready to tolerate him, but I'm not really ready to tolerate you. My Baal Pilopos, we start with the Gemara, we're in the middle of Ein Zayin Aleph. the right in the middle of the Amud. My Baal Pelopis, I'm Rav Yehuda, I'm a Shmuel, Reach HaChotam. So Baal Pelopis, the Gemara gives a couple of explanations. It's a Reach HaChotam, a smell emitting from the nose. When Masisatan Reach HaPeh, a smell emitting from the mouth, otherwise known as bad breath. Rav Asi Masni Ipcha. Rav Asi has Shmuel stating the position that it's bad breath. Umanach Basimana, and just to help you remember that it's Shmuel who was the one who said that the definition of Baal Pelopis is bad breath. So you'll say the following: Shmuel pasuk pume mikule pirkin. Shmuel's all over this perek, meaning Shmuel kept talking about this perek. Meaning, interesting, by the way, this is a great idea for tonight. You review this perek as we are now approaching the end of the perek, and you'll notice how many times Shmuel makes a comment on one of the mishnayos in this perek. Meaning Shmuel's really all over this. He's all over this perek, and so it's a mnemonic. It's a memory aid. So now it's not the greatest visual, but now you think about Shmuel talking, and now you think about our mishnah about the Baal Pelopis, and Shmuel says that's talking about the bad breath. Hamikamets. My mikamets. I'm reviewed as that. Hamikabets. So as klavim. Mikamets. It's funny in the Torah. It's one of the greatest. It's an avoda of the Kohen. In the context of our Mishnah, it's somebody who collects dog excrement. Based where the Gemara challenges mikamets uborsi. We have a brisa that describes mikamets as being a tanner. And the Gemara says, look, I know that Bryce is difficult, but that Bryce is difficult. Meaning, did you see what we saw in our Mishnah? Hamikamet v'amitzar from Nechoshes v'aborsi. Our Mishnah lists them at two separate things. So clearly the Bryce can't be right. So Bishlam, amasis lo kasha kam b'aborsi gadol kam b'aborsi katan. So the Gemara says, well, maybe the Mishnah is right, and maybe the Bryce is right. Maybe there are two types of tanners. Maybe there's an industrial tanner, and maybe there's like a boutique tanner, if you will. So Ela l'Rav Yehuda, kasha. But according to Rav Yehuda, however, it's difficult because Rav Yehuda describes the Mekamets as being a collector of dog excrement. So the Gemara says Tanahi. Well, the Gemara says, look, I'll show you another Braisa. Titanya, Mekamets uborsi v'yeshorim zeh Mekamets zeh ha-Mekamets toas kalavim. Okay, so we have another Braisa. And in this Braisa, one of the interpretations of Mekamets is someone who collects dog excrement. And again, the problem is that he comes up every night and he's just got a foul odor. Ha-Mitzarf nechoshes v'aborsi. My Mitzarf Nechosha, so what is this? Now, I called him a minor. The Gemara is going to bring in two opinions. Rav Ashi Amar Chash Ledudei, he's a pot maker, fashioning earthenware. And again, I guess, I don't know enough about this, but I guess he's got a foul odor and he comes home smelling terrible. Rabba Barbachana Amar Zemachatech Nechoshas Mi'ikaro. Okay, now we get to the idea that he's a minor. He digs... copper from the ground. Tanya Kavase de Rabba Barbakana is a mitzarv zemechatech nechoshes mikaro, and the brisa supports this interpretation that it's a minor. I'm Rav Huna. Any zamein mafarnes yotzi v'tink suva. Rav is of the opinion that if the husband refuses to support his wife, so yotzi v'tink suva. So again, intolerable situation. He can't do that. He doesn't. She has the right to say to him, "You keep your food, and I'll keep my earnings." But he cannot be the one saying, "I'm not going to feed you." Azal Rav Elazar Amar Lishmaita Kamen to Shmuel. This was repeated to Shmuel. Amar Achsu Sarei La Elazar. So Shmuel did not have pleasant things to say about this opinion, right? He speaks a little harshly. He says, "You know, feed him barley. Barley, as we know, is animal food. I eat it every Shabbos in my children. It's delicious, but the barley, generally speaking, is animal food, and so the sota gets has her mincha is made up of barley. So anyway, so it's an expression that basically I'm displeased with what he said. I understand. Force a divorce. If Basin's going to get involved, why doesn't Basin just force him to feed her? Meaning that would be a simpler way to both resolve the situation and try to maintain a marriage. So Rav says, no, he doesn't agree with that solution. Because if the husband is refusing to feed his wife, that's reflective of a personality. In other words, yeah, Basin will come in and say, you know, you need to feed her. Okay, Basin's putting the chokehold on me. I got to feed her. So, but it doesn't address the larger issue, which is, he's a snake. right? His personality is such where he's refusing to feed her, and so Rav's of the opinion that that's just simply an intolerable situation, and therefore Beis Din's going to coerce a divorce. Kisalik Rabbi Zera Ashkechel Rabbi Yamin Bar Yafet Yosef Vekamalam Mishmed Rabbi Yochanan. He said the same halacha over in the name of Rav Yochanan. Amarle adachsu saron halazer bebavel, and he says, "Oh, it's interesting. I was in Bavel and I heard the same thing, and I heard Shmuel voice such a strong displeasure to this halacha that if a man refuses to feed his wife, so you force a divorce." And Shmuel disagrees. Shmuel said, "No, you force him to feed." Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav Asi, and Maasin Ella Lipsolos. When do Beis Din coerce a divorce? The word Maasin means Beis Din will coerce a divorce. So that's only going to be true if the marriage is prohibited by the Torah. Ki Amar Yisi Kamen to Shmuel Amar Kagon, and the matter was told to Shmuel, and Shmuel gave a number of examples. Amar L'Kohen Gadol L'Grusha for Chalutz L'Kohen Hedjot, Mamzer Asu Nesina L'Yisrael, Basi Sol Nesina L'Mamzer. All these cases where the Torah prohibits the marriage. Now, the truth of the matter is that in some of these cases, it's rabbinically forbidden. But still, the point is, it's an Isser. They're living in Isser. Aval Nasi Shevashayim Ma'aser Shanim. But taking us way back, not way back, but to the sixth parak of Yevamos, where we discussed over there, if a man and woman are married for 10 years and they don't have a child, so then it's grounds for divorce. We learned it from Avram and Sarah. Grounds for divorce, although Sarah didn't get a divorce. Sarah then just gave Avram another wife. But anyway, but in order for him to fulfill the mitzvah per revu, he's got to find another woman. V'lo yalda ain't, I'm sorry, so Esther Shana v'lo yalda ain't kofin. Oh, so now, even though it's grounds for divorce, but Beis Din won't get involved because that's not Isser. That's not like any of the descriptions that we had earlier. Now, Rav Tachlifa disagrees. In this case, he also is of the opinion that a divorce is going to be coerced by Beis Din. Tanan, the Gemara turns to our Mishnah. Look at our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says, in these cases, we force the divorce. Now, according to Rav Ashi, perfect. Why? Because Rav Ashi says, look, our Mishnah is telling us something that we would have not known otherwise. Meaning, what we would have known already is that if a man and a woman are married in sin, they're violating an aver in the Torah, like all the examples that we gave, so then Beis Din gets involved and Beis Din's going to coerce the divorce. Fine. Our Mishnah is telling us, and if the on top of that, and if the marriage is intolerable because he's suffering from one of these ailments or he's so foul smelling, so Beis Din also is going to force a divorce as well. Okay. So from Rav Ashi's standpoint, our Mishnah is a perfect complement to what we already knew. Eller Rav Tachlifa Bar Avima listening Nasa Isha V'Shayim Ma'aser Shanim V'lo Yalda Kofenoso. But according to Rav Tachlifa, you see, he's in a more uncomfortable position. Because if you're married in Isser, Beis Din's going to coerce a divorce. If the marriage is intolerable like our Mishnah, Beis Din's going to force a coerce a divorce. What about that? What about that case where a man and woman are married for 10 years and they don't have a child? That's not an Isser. It's not an intolerable situation. It doesn't have a category. So, according to Rav Tachlifa, where does he belong? I'm Rav Nachman Lo Kasha Habemili Abishute. So, the Gemara says no. He still there's still a place for Rav Tachlifa's position. Armish is talking about the coercion of a divorce. And it's not just Beis Din is encouraging a divorce. Beis Din will be forcing a divorce because it's just simply intolerable. He's foul smelling. He's got a blemish that's just simply it's simply intolerable. And Beis Din understands that, and Beis Din will go over and not only knock on his door, but knock on other things as well in order to coerce a divorce. Masha Ein Kein, a man and woman live 10 years together and they don't have a child. So there, it's not an avera. It's not intolerable. Basin's going to encourage. That's what the Gemara says. Habemili, Matkala Rav Avi b'dvarim lo yivaser aved. So the Rabbi Abba says, look, you know, right? I'm in the business of encouraging others, right? And hitting is in the education world has been out for now, I'd say about a generation. And all I got are words. And the Pasuk of Mishlei beat me to the punch on this one. B'dvarim lo yivaser avid. You know, you're not going to get your slave to move if you don't give him mussar. Mussar meaning, you know, more than just encouraging words. So what good is it if Beis Din comes over and simply politely says to him, you know, you should get a divorce. It's not gonna move him. Elam Rabbi Abba hava habishute. So Rabbi Abba says encouragement means coercion, meaning Beis Din is going to physically get involved. So Hasam ki amra havin ba'adei shafkinala. Hachaf agav de amra havin ba'adei lo shafkinala. So the Gemara says, okay, so we're going to make the following distinction. When it comes to a Mishnah, and the woman says, oh, you know what? I can handle it. Meaning, I know he's foul-smelling, I can handle it. So then Beis Din backs away. Beis Din will say, okay, look, the only reason why we're coercing the divorce is because we're assuming, right, it's such an intolerable marriage, you don't want it. And Beis Din is therefore going to get involved. And involvement means Beis Din will be knocking on the husband to give him to force him to give her a divorce. But if she says I can handle it, so fine. So Beis Din will retract. As opposed to the marriage that went 10 years without a child. So there, even if she says it's okay, no, it's not okay. In other words, the mitzvah per revu is not being fulfilled.
Even if it's his deficiency,
we don't know. We don't know whose deficiency it is. So the Gemara says but what about Mukashchin? We learned together in the Mishnah that when it comes to Mukashchin, so Beis Din does not back off. Did none. Chutz mi mukashim imneshim amakaso. V'ktani hasam ki amra dairena ba'adei b'sahadei shavkinala. Now over there, let's say she loves him so much that she's willing to accept the fact that she's mukashchin. What about the fact that they can't be intimate? Fine. I'll create a situation where we're not going to be intimate. We'll have I'll invite the family to live with us. I know it's strange. So afa gav de amra dairin ba'adei besad de lo shavkinala. As opposed to in the case where 10 years of marriage and they didn't have a child. So once again, there's no argument that she can make, which would be, you know what? Let's try to tolerate this. Tanya, let's just do a little bit more for today and leave ourselves off with Rabbi Shuv and Levi for tomorrow. Tanya, amar Rabbi Yossi sachli zakenecha mesher yishleim asara esem va'arba mukish chinhein. There are 24 different categories of boils. And in all of these cases, so intimacy between a man and a woman, a man suffering from boils, is only going to exacerbate the situation. The worst of them is what's called Bale Ra'asan, a terrible form of Mukashchin. So the Gemara says, and the Gemara gives us a genetic cause for it, not genetic, but a congenital cause for it. A person bloodlets and has relations with his wife right afterwards. So the children are going to be weaker children. Now, if both of them bloodlet and they had relations immediately afterwards, havilam banim bali ra'asan. So the Gemara says is that that would be a ground for having a child of suffering from this ailment. Gemara says if you eat something after you bloodlet, so then there's nothing to worry about. Mani simane. The Gemara says what are the symptoms that show that he's a bali ra'asan? So dafanena, his eyes are running, v'dai v'nechore, nasal drip, v'aisele, riri mipume, and he's got saliva coming out of his mouth. V'ramudit ve'ilave. And, I got stuck on this last one. And flies are attacking him all the time. My asuse. Okay, we'll finish off today with a little bit of Gemara surgery. Okay, every now and then we get the medicine of the Gemara. You know, the Gaonim already told us, don't try this at home. Don't practice this, but it's very interesting. We'll be treated to a little surgery in the time of the Gemara. My asuse. How do you heal it? Amar Abaye Pila, Veludna Grida da Aguza, Vigrida da Ashba, Vikail Malka, Umitchala Didikle Sumke. You take a whole bunch of natural ingredients. Please forgive me, I'm not going to translate every one of them. Vishaklahu Bahade Hadade then you're going to boil them together. And go into a sterilized room. It's very interesting. Meaning there's a marble house, there's no breeze, there's no wind going into the house. If you don't have a marble house, at least make sure that the walls are 7.5 bricks thick. And start pouring this over his head. And then until the skull is soft. Adarafi arese demuche. Vikari lemuche. And open up the skull. Umaisi arba tarfe da aso madle kochad kare umusev chad. Vishakab tsifsa. And some sort of parasite that is existing on the actual brain. And so what you're going to do is you're going to take the four legs of the parasite and put it on four leaves. And that way you can now take it off the brain. Vikari le, make sure to burn it. Because if you don't burn it, it'll just go right back to the person. Okay, so a little, I was going to say minor surgery. Doesn't sound minor, but it sounds major. A little minor surgery that ends today. Okay, almost finished with the perek. Come back tomorrow. Tomorrow, the story of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Certainly one of the most popular stories in Shas. It's going to finish up the seventh perek, and then, God willing, start the eighth perek of the Masechta tomorrow.